everyone. I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today's theme is one that should impact everyone in our audience. It's very upbeat. It's very positive. It's about taking control of your life. Because a lot of problems right now in the world is because we don't have control. We can't control the circumstances. We couldn't control the circumstances around COVID or whether or not our business would be closed, if we'd lose our career, not just our job, the consequences to our health of being confined to a space, wearing masks, the stress people are under, the fact that children today, many of them in America, millions, don't have enough food each day. It's easy to understand how all this will have a negative impact upon our well-being. So this is a lecture I've done specifically to help people better understand how to manage the issues in their life in a more healthy and positive way. Now, to that lecture before live audience, taking control of your life.
Looking back on your earlier life decisions, I'm meaning college and job and marriage and family and home and responsibilities, did anyone in your early life ever encourage you to challenge those decisions as being inappropriate for you? Okay? No and yes. All right? I'm sure with most people, and I'm talking about the majority, we were encouraged to follow a path where the guidance was given. Well-intentioned. And sometimes it worked. But an awful lot of the time, you wake up today at 30, 40, 50, and you ask yourself, well, gee whiz, I've done everything I was supposed to do to be happy. Why am I not happy? Why is there still something missing in my life? And we didn't think we had an opportunity to be a part of that input when we were going to college. College is rather unique in a society that says that it's willing to be open to the complete learning experience of everyone. How often, indeed, do they really honor people who have a broad-based understanding of life rather than the person that specializes and imbalances their life? At the very time society says, balance it, work and play, family and friends, job and relaxation, and yet the person that gets the advantage is almost always the person that intentionally imbalances themselves to go to an excess, and we pay attention to the excess more than we do the balance, right? The person that gets ahead in our country is the person that's almost always excessive. In anything they do, they become excessive. Now, sometimes they're excessive where their excess stands out, and other times it doesn't. Sometimes they intentionally make themselves an exhibitionist within their excesses, like the person has to brag about the A's they got. Well, how does a person get straight A's unless they do an awful lot of studying? Well, what about the person who doesn't want a straight A, but merely wants to understand, comprehend, and utilize the material to which they're supposed to be learning, but not to a point where they have to impress anyone, just where they know it? And at the same time, have time to do the other things that still made life important, like sharing time with family and friends and loved ones and themselves. Now, to me, a more balanced person is a person that does not go to excess. Therefore, by their very nature, will not be as committed to what our society says in a very divisive way. Don't imbalance yourself, but if you do, boy, are we going to reward you. Well, which direction are you going to go? You're going to go to where so often the reward is. And the reward is always with the excess. I mean, think back to the people who got ahead. Think how motivated and driven they were. Think of what they were willing to do that you weren't willing to do. Think about what they were willing to put into their life that you weren't. And what did they exclude from their life that you didn't? Now, suddenly you're looking at someone who has things and acceptance and has gotten a position that you didn't get, and yet you're the more balanced person. You're the more rounded person. You're the more whole person. You're then denied the same access to acceptance for being balanced. So then society somehow has got it wrong. If you say you're going to reward balance and you continue to reward excess, then get your story straight. And if society won't get its story straight, it seems incapable of doing that, then what's your option? What's your option? What can you do? If they keep defining a rule to which they dishonor the people who achieve it? don't pay attention to social standards. Now they tell you then on the other end of that, if you don't pay attention to us, and if you don't become a member of something, then you're automatically excluded. So on the one hand, they want us to belong, to join. So we do. And that's a part of our decision process that we think we don't have an option in. So we're taught that you got to go to school, and then once in school, you've got to do this. So already in school, we're thinking about our career. The first career. Now we're not even, when I was in school, it was, you know, in your college year, your senior year in high school, you started thinking about college. You didn't think about it before because you were so concerned about high school. Now it's seventh grade, they're thinking about college. Well, that's ridiculous. But that's the way the mind works today. Kids are 2 years old and they're already being taught to be in computer school, learn advanced systems. By four, they're supposed to learn two languages. Well, when do they have time to be a child, to make mistakes, to be more rounded? So as a result, we end up having a whole generation, my generation, your generation, that grew up grossly in imbalance. Now, we were very good at what we learned, and we succeeded at that. But how much fulfillment came with our success? It's like the doctor that knows everything about the brain and is very good, but knows nothing about the rest of the body. Therefore, if you came to that doctor and you had a headache, they're going to want to look in your brain. They're not going to look at your diet, see if it was hypoglycemia, and see if it was low thyroid, because from the neck down, they're not an expert. They didn't have the roundedness. They put it into their expertise, into their specialization. And the more specialized you become, the more limited you become, because energy cannot be shared in two places simultaneously. To the degree that you extend yourself in one area, you can commonly reduce your energy everywhere else. Now, the same thing is true about a belief system. A belief system would have you accept that you're in control of your choices. Fair enough. They'll even give you options in the school, but they want to motivate you. If your father came or mother came from an Ivy League school, think how many times they want you to go to the Ivy League school to keep on the tradition. As a part of the honoring of the parent, you will go back to that school in all likelihood, or one like it. Now, if they're in a career, you want to be a careerist. Again, this is part of the tacit understanding. I'm not suggesting this is wrong. This is not about right and wrong. This is merely about showing you how you ended up becoming out of control of your life. If you understand how you got out of control, then at least you have some options to recontrolling your life. If you don't understand the mechanisms, you'll keep repeating the same patterns over and over again. Intellectually, you'll understand something's wrong. Viscerally, you'll feel it, but functionally, you won't change it. So now you've gone to school. You've taken your courses. You've honored that part of your transition from one place in life where you could do anything, be anyone, hang out, go rollerblade in Venice Beach, right? And now you're not rollerblading, you're studying. You're seeing, you're told, you're conditioned to believe that there's a limitation of jobs. Now you got to get the straight A's. Get into medical school, no one gets into medical school with C's. Very few get into any good school with B's, and even those with straight A's still are in high-level competition. Well, how do you get straight A's and have a balanced life? You can't. It doesn't work. So therefore, the very nature of what they've told us allows us to be a good physician ends up causing us to be a limited physician. So the structure of the paradigm itself is flawed. Now you get through college, you go out, and what's almost the first thing you do by the time you're out of college? Huh? Huh? Get a job, right?
Get married.
Have kids. You don't get a job, get married, have kids, and then travel. Doesn't work that way. No? All right. Your parents were from Haight-Ashbury. It was different. They were tripping half the time. They didn't know where they were at. Your name was Charity or something like that. It changed daily, you know.
Go back home.
Leave home.
What else happens? What else happens?
Leave home again.
When you're out of home, when you're out of school, you got a job, what else?
You get in debt.
You immediately create debt because you're taught that success equals possession, therefore debt equals success. The more debt you create, the more successful you become, right? Now, what do we reward in society as far as success? We look at a person that has materialistic success. The degrees on their wall, right? the status of their home, their clothing, their position, how many people work for them, who works for them, how many employees they have, who they have below them, and how close they are to the top in any situation. That's considered success. And we reward that. We give a person more debt. We give them a capacity to earn more debt. Because it's very rare that anyone that you've ever met or anyone currently in America is successful materialistically and also has a balanced life. Because the very same choice to be a specialist and exceed the limits of normal boundaries of productivity and work is the same mind that does not limit itself in the debt that it accumulates and the possessions that it needs in order to establish that its choice was right. So the very nature of the choice you took has to be justified by the excesses that you extend yourself to. Think of that for a moment. That explains an awful lot of why a lot of rich people are very insecure and very unhappy. How can they be happy? We are not taught a minimalist concept of life. We're taught excess is equal to success. You don't see average people featured in any magazine. You don't see a person that's successful at living in People magazine, right? Success as measured by a different standard, someone who made a different choice. Because we're not led to believe that the choice is really ours. Because behind our choice are a lot of voices and a lot of motivation, a lot of shame, guilt, fear, that we're not honoring someone else's choice for us. So we learn the art of codependency. We work through other people's choices. Now, what's that mean? It means one day you wake up and you've got a job, a family, a house, a lot of debt, a lot of pressure, but you don't have a joy of living per se. You try to snatch moments of joy in each of the above. How can you have a rounded life and give your children the time they need, give your house the time it needs, give yourself what you need, even give your job and patients or your job and your the people you're servicing what they need if you've gone to the excess and automatically all belief systems push the excess when it comes to success? Now, unfortunately, that wasn't your choice. You thought it was, but it wasn't. I'm suggesting that was someone else's choice to put you in the school you went to, got you married, got you a job, even how many children you're going to have, where you're going to live. That was someone else always meddling in your life. And if you doubt that, go back and start remembering all the conversations you had and whose advice did you believe? Whose advice did you listen to? Who were you trying to emulate? You were trying to emulate that which you thought would give you sanctuary, security. Now, how many of our fathers, I'm talking about people from the age of 35 to 50, the baby boomers, how many of our fathers gave us quality time? A lot of time. How many of your fathers my age didn't have the time to give you because they were so busy being responsible for all the things that they felt that if they weren't busy being, they would feel ashamed or guilt of not being responsible people? Wasn't they didn't love you, it's just there was no time for you. But then again, there was no time for anything else because the total burden of what a person was supposed to carry was greater than the sum of their assets as a person to manage. Then we wondered why they would frequently and or sometimes in their own quiet ways or their own non-quiet ways would break down and need some form of sublimation, either drinking or some form of diversion just to be able to keep their sanity. Instead of looking at the fundamental flaw in the whole belief system, we encouraged it. We kept our mouth shut. And we went right back out there and did the same thing, only we did it even more emphatically. Where our fathers didn't have advanced educations and didn't go far in their career fast enough, we wanted to show that we would be the first generation that would get it all. The advanced degrees, the advanced career, the advanced materialism, more houses, more of everything, and have more time for everybody. Wall Street is littered with the psychic corpses of people who burn out along the way with the values in the wrong direction. Every institution in America has a lot of these people. millions upon millions of people got it wrong. It was kind of hard when you get it wrong to say, hey, sorry, I got it wrong, got to do something else. Right? You got to acknowledge vulnerability. But we weren't allowed to acknowledge vulnerability. Our parents certainly didn't acknowledge vulnerability. They wouldn't acknowledge anything. They were the generation that had gone through enormous suffering, gone through enormous deprivation. And therefore, whatever they had, they wanted to hold on to. So they were so insecure after a depression that they made sure that there was something permanent. So they kept talking about the permanency of life. We bought into the idea that life should be permanent. Our home should be permanent. Our friends should be permanent. Our children's love should be permanent. Our affiliation, our job. Well, then one day we wake up in the 1980s and we see the jobs are going in and out. You know, that there is no security. That families are falling apart. That the reasons we were together are frequently out of insecurity. And anytime you're in a relationship because you're insecure, then the entire foundation of the relationship is insecure, no matter what you wrap it in, no matter how many gifts you give. Or how many times you tell something to someone, if you are insecure, the relationship is flawed. It cannot succeed unless something changes. So life is not about repairing and doing more. It's about taking a step back and making new choices. Could you imagine? What would be the choices that would be different today if you would have done it all differently? Would you have gone necessarily to that college? Would you have gone into that career? Would you have changed things knowing what you know now? How many people in this room would have done it differently? Good, and the rest of you are liars. All right? Baby boomers hate to admit that. No, Gary, I would work just as hard and even harder. And I'd be more anally retentive, and I haven't had a bowel movement in a year, and it'd be 3 years. But I make more money than you. Well, that's fine. Play in your money. Hetty Green did, you can too. So the first issue is decisions. You are not irrevocably restricted by your early decisions. Now that's an important issue to deal with into itself. The whole idea that you can't change. Too much to lose. I frequently find that the more you lose, the more you give up, the more you give away, the more changes in your choices, the more freer you become. After all, what's the whole point of the exercise of life? What do you want from it? Once you know what you want from it, then you've got to take a look to see if what you've got is what is going to give you the happiness that you want. Name the material, non-material success of your life. All right, now we can, material, cars, clothes, houses, status. But look at what's really important. Here's what we never acknowledge people for. How about the success of raising a child that's happy, balanced, and whole? Who then is more successful at life? Who should get the accolades? John. Or a person that has a child that's so happy and so balanced and so whole that they're going to be able to go through life enjoying and honoring their life as they should. Who then is more successful? One we honor, they get on the cover of every magazine, they get interviewed, and the other is invisible. How about the person that has a happy relationship? One not based upon need. One not based upon artificial constructs and codependencies. One not based upon hiding your fears within someone else's capacity to honor those fears in subtle ways where you never have to be completely honest and they never have to be completely compliant. You live in a pseudo-mocking relationship. But beneath it, there's a gross feeling of incompleteness. Well, what if you had a complete relationship? What if it was unconditionally giving, unconditionally sharing? Remember, you know whether or not you got such a relationship? Let me tell you what you won't have in that relationship. Jealousy, envy, greed cannot exist in a healthy relationship. The moment you fear losing someone, you've already lost them. Because then you're not holding on to a person, you're holding on to an object that represents the extension of your fear. So, the way to change that is to change what it is that you're really sharing in a relationship. If you're in a relationship because you fear that the person that you're with is the only person that's going to be able to give you what you need, then that's an insecure relationship. What's going to happen when the person doesn't meet your expectations? And mind you, Anyone who has a relationship based upon those principles will always undermine it, because at a certain point, you're going to challenge it, the person's not going to come up to what you need, and you're going to dispose of that person. But before such, you go through a whole ritual slaughter. You depreciate the person. You start an emasculation process that finally allows you to junk them, as if somehow the person wasn't good enough for you. Instead of saying, I was in this relationship for the wrong reasons, for the wrong purpose, with the wrong person. And most relationships in our society are based upon the wrong reasons because, again, the choices. We weren't taught when I was growing up that being single was a normal thing. We were taught you had to go out and get married right away, have children right away to make us, quote, happy. Well, did it ever occur to you that you weren't marrying your parents or grandparents, but they made sure that their needs were part of your life if they were one of those people that their choice became a part of the reason you did something? Well, think if you didn't honor them and honored yourself. Who would you have married? What if you wanted to be single? I love being single. For me, single is a normal state of being. Do you know what that means when you go out with someone? If they're not very clear that you're not going to be going out with them, so that the ritual of the romance, the ritual of the sexuality, the ritual of I gave you this, so now I get that. Well, what happens if you say, hey, Jack, I don't need any of that. There's nothing you've got I need. So there's nothing you can do that I can't do and be fulfilled in my own life. I am fulfilled. I'm whole. I'm happy. So therefore, if I'm with you, it's simply to be with you. There's nothing that has to come before it or after it. Well, oh, brother, does that change the choices? Suddenly people start to think, well, hold on a second. Is it worth going out with him? I mean, if I'm not going to end up getting married or becoming that essential part of that relationship, then it isn't worth going out with him. That's one. It's better to have someone say, hey, it ain't worth it. You're not going to be my other half for whatever reason they want. For instance, how many people got married not because they loved the other person, because they needed a house, they needed a home, they needed a job, they needed a career, they needed someone else in their life, they needed a sexual partner. But all that dims very quickly. What if the only person you had in your life was one you didn't need?
That's great.
How would you treat him then? Differently. If you didn't need the person, then you could finally let them be who they are, right? You wouldn't have to manipulate, control. There wouldn't be any need for abuse. There wouldn't need to be any miscommunications of needs and expectations not met, because you're allowing the person to be who they are. You're honoring the person. You have the unconditional love of yourself. You don't need anyone else to feel any more love for who you are. And yet in our life, think of how many times that we equated love of self with success of self. So when a person's not succeeding in life, they're supposed to feel bad about themselves. Now maybe I'm wrong on this, but I always kind of got the idea that it didn't matter what I was doing in life, as long as I still remembered my most important asset was my unconditional love of myself, then I don't fail ever in life, because I've always got me. Now, if I have to base the love of myself upon whether or not I'm successful at something and whether I please you or you, then I'm in a lot of trouble, because I can't please all the people. And I can't set a whole lot of false expectations and goals, not meet them, and then feel bad about not having met them. How many people end up getting depressed because they don't meet their goals? That's to assume the goal is greater than the process of self-achieving a goal. Goals are not in and of themselves significant. The process is. Lose contact with yourself in the process of achieving a goal, and then you have no self. Understand the relationship of love to the unconditional self, and no matter what you do in life, you're always going to be successful, because you never leave yourself. You never lose yourself, and you never depreciate yourself. So it's like saying, no matter what I do, I'm still successful, because I still got me, and my love isn't going to go down because of what I'm doing isn't going up. Instead, we got all these mamby-pambies out there. Every time they do something that doesn't work, they're depressed. They go through self-deprivation syndrome. And then they start watching these stupid television shows or going to therapists trying to figure out why their self-esteem's down. Franco's the only guy I know. He goes to a therapist just to lower his self-esteem. I know. Do you understand what I'm saying here? Think of the choices that would be different. Think of who you wouldn't have to use and how you would use them in order to get someone in your life to think well of you. Think of how many people you've put in your life solely for the reason to make you feel good about yourself. Think of that. That's using those people. Using them, and in time, abusing them. And then making yourself feel like the victim, and then going out and doing it again. Choices change when you say, the control's with me. So it takes a very different type of person to assume that they don't need anybody in their life to feel good about who they are, and therefore whoever's in their life is there unconditionally. So this whole idea of permanent life and death, that's a societal thing. They need that because they're terrified of the idea of creating the notion you could be autonomous. Think of how many women in this room were encouraged to get married real quick and have children, right? Yeah. What if you would have had the choice to have not gotten married and saw the world and experienced more people and had children later if you wanted to or not, and not because someone else was pressuring you? You would be a different person, right?
Literally. I went the whole 9 yards in the 70s. I had 3 kids in 4.5 years. I was divorced in 6, and I raised my kids by myself.
Okay, so a lot of your life was lived upon someone else's notion of your choice.
Exactly.
Well, as of today, you shouldn't give your choice ever away to anyone else.
I have no intention.
Good. But you learned a hard lesson from that. I'm suggesting most people learn this hard lesson, but never learn the lesson. They experience the lesson, they just don't learn it. But in our society, we're terrified of the autonomous person. Why are we afraid of people like me? What's so terrifying about me?
Not conventional.
I'm not conventional, right?
Can't be controlled, right?
I'm making money off of you.
Because I'm only one of 3 healthy heterosexuals left in New York. That's true. It's absolutely true. I read it somewhere. I don't know.
Because you don't need anyone.
Huh?
You don't need anyone.
Because I don't need anybody. Therefore, I can honor the people who they are for who they are and for what they can do. I don't have to place artificial standards on people to meet something that's deficient in myself. Therefore, I'm not living my ego through another person or vice versa.
Totally independent.
Completely independent.
Everybody?
Of everybody. Now, what's it mean to be that independent? It means that that's when you start to feel real love. The irony of it is, the people who think that makes you cold and aloof, to the contrary. It makes you warmer and more honest in what you share. Because it comes from the heart, no hidden agenda, no false motivation. There's no game. And in a society that breeds games as a part of its value system and in the way that we're taught to live and the values we're taught to achieve, that's dangerous. Because if I can do it, and some of you have possibly done it, then it means it can be done. All it takes is one person to do something. And then once one person does it, then anybody can do it. And that's what they're afraid of, because then they lose control over you. Remember, society functions artificially. We have an artificial construct of a society. Take a look at what it really represents. What have we gotten for all that we've invested in this belief system? Look at the drugs. Look at the crime. Look at the hatred. Look at the violence. Look at the white trash and the black trash and the blue trash and all the other racial trash that we now see on television hating one another. Well, that's what our society has come to. Ugly confrontational biases. It's lowered all the sense of self. So instead of looking for answers to these crises these people are having in their life, to give them strength and character and quality, they simply display the worst that human nature can be and say, every day we'll give you another guest, another group of people who are willing to vent in anger and show how dysfunctional they are. And other people say, yeah, I'm just like that.
It's for ratings.
It's not, no. Understand something. Before they were on television, they existed. Mm-hmm. All right? If the Oklahoma bomber hadn't been bombing that building, they'd be doing some other crime. Mm-hmm. Murder, rapes, robberies, killing. It was in their nature because they had chosen that. They had chosen an anti-social, anti-humanistic way of expressing themselves. It didn't start with Waco. This has been, you'll find it was right through their whole character. We've got a lot of people out there like that. I mean, the majority of people are like that. So it's only a small percentage of the population that's actually holding society together at all. I mean, we're being held together. This great dysfunctional society is being held by a string of maybe 5 to 7% of the people who are still functional and spiritual and have any values at all. The trouble is, the majority is not challenging its own belief systems to see what's dysfunctional in the belief system that's causing these inappropriate choices, because it doesn't want to give the power back. There's a danger when you give power back. When you give power back, you no longer can control it. So when I talk about success of living, I'm talking about being healthy. That's a choice. Hey, I think if you're healthy, it's a success, because you cannot be healthy by accident. Health is a process to which you must address yourself every moment of every day, mentally and physically. When you think a negative thought, your body responds with a disease process. A positive thought is a healing process. There is no neutral place in life. It's not where you can get and be secure because you've lost enough weight. That's a supercilious, overly simplified notion that society has. The doctor says, well, you're well because I can't find a classical disease. Well, did the doctor ask you how you feel? If you're functional or dysfunctional? If you're under stress or not? Does he look at your blood chemistry and see if you have viruses or bacteria or parasites? Does he look to see if your adrenals are functioning or not? No. They're making an overly simplistic model of health and disease. Symptomatic, classical definition of a disease, and you're sick. In absence of a classically defined disease, you are well. Well, that's absurd. That takes you out of being responsible for anything you do or who you are. I just saw a report tonight that 36% of people with HIV infection are practicing unsafe sex. Do you have any idea the number exponential people they will infect? And there was a guy who said, yes, he was on television. He says, yes, I intentionally had unsafe sex and I infected other people who died. When I was invited to give a lecture on lifestyle and HIV based upon thousands of interviews I had done in San Francisco, LA, and New York, I was booed off the stage because the gays in that audience did not want for one second to hear me talk about that they had to be responsible because the responsibility was theirs. And it was a message they couldn't hear. But then again, as I later said, one guy came up to me afterwards and who had invited me. And he said, gee whiz, you know, I'm sorry they acted this way. And I said, why did you expect them to act any different? And he said, well, after all, I mean, they're gay, Gary. They should be, and he started going through all the things a gay person should be. And I said, hold on a second. Do you think for a moment because you are gay that that makes you special and different and unique as far as being open-minded, progressive? I said, most people who are gay are no different than most people who are heterosexual. You will take on a belief system. You will take on an orthodoxy. Look how many wear their hair short and cropped, wear clothes in a certain way, go out to the beaches in Fire Island, hang out in certain places, talk about persons who are straight in almost a what I call a heterophobic mode, mockingly, like somehow they ain't as hip as us, they ain't as sharp as us, they ain't as cutting as us. Well, gee whiz, is that not an orthodoxy that fears a challenge to its own identity? Now, if you come along and say that, hold on, something in your lifestyle, something in your behavior could be contributing to your incidence of disease, not just AIDS, but hepatitis and other conditions. If you say, I wasn't aware of that, that's one thing, and I can change that. But if you start to defend yourself by defending what you belong to in the larger orthodoxy, just like someone who's in a religion, you start talking about the disadvantages of that particular religion. Let's say you're talking about the Moonies, the Unification Church, and you say, do you realize this? And suddenly you'll see their eyes glaze over, boom. Then you'll see the counterattack starting. And suddenly they're not protecting their own health. They're protecting the need to be a part of something that their identity comes from. Now, you can justify it and say, well, okay, but remember, society has rejected this. Society has rejected anything that's different. But it rejects it until it becomes successful, and until it becomes so exhibitionistic, then it rewards it. Isn't it ironic? The very things that society says it's offended by, the most conservative society, when you exceed all the boundaries and you break out, then society says, wow, let's put money and fame in your pocket. It doesn't matter that what you might be doing may not be that unique or that talented or that special. Just the idea of being that different. So just as when I try to talk with people who say, well, you're going to criticize my diet? I mean, I'm all American. I eat meat and potatoes. No different. Well, what you're eating is contributing to disease. Instead of saying, yes, that makes sense, let me examine that, you'll see the defense mechanism start to come up. Because every belief system has a defense mechanism. Every belief system. And now, you're not dealing with that person. You're dealing with all their belief systems. You're dealing with their orthodoxy. And I've learned a lesson through life. You cannot challenge orthodoxy. It doesn't blink and it doesn't move. It becomes intractable. It can't, because to acknowledge that there's a flaw in any part is to acknowledge that it's vulnerable. And part of the success in any orthodoxy and the reason that people are drawn to orthodoxy is because of the certainty it gives. I am certain that if I go to this club, I'm only going to meet heterosexuals, this club, gays, this club, orientals. And suddenly we start taking our identity from the certainty of what is predictable by our patterns of belief, behavior, dress, style. And therefore we become a part of that other belief system's choices, no longer our free choice. We think it is. We think when we get dressed up, we think when we go to a job, it's our choice. It isn't. It's a choice also the larger orthodoxy that we're a part of. And that makes a big difference. Because you immediately then have to exclude a lot of ideas. You have to deny a lot of possibilities. You certainly have to deny anything that would change your beliefs. And that's why with millions of books written, billions of words written, thousands upon thousands of lectures per year on all forms of peace, love, transformation, health, we've learned nothing. Right? The reality is we haven't, because we're sicker than ever, more disease than ever, more violent than ever. So if it really mattered, if these things mattered, we would have changed. Now there's a lot of good in a lot of these different beliefs. In books and articles and documentaries, there's a lot of good. But you can't trust what's going to be allowed in and what's not. Because if you allow something in from another system of beliefs, and it challenges anything that's fundamental in your beliefs, then it challenges you to change. Well, when is change going to stop? So they don't allow any change, unless they control it. Unless one of their own writes it, in which case it will not be a challenge. It will be an addendum to the belief system. And it's in every belief system. Now, what if you had success, not just in health, now you're not diseased, but you're happy, it gives you a lot of options, gives you a lot more choices when you're healthy, because health can't be based upon fear. Here's a phenomenon. You cannot be healthy by making choices out of fear. Fear negates positive choices. Fear is self-limiting. Fear keeps bringing you back to the predictable. Health allows you a larger window of opportunity, more realities to interplay with. Fear keeps you limited to one reality. You may want other realities, you may be exposed to them, but they don't filter into where it resonates change. So health allows you a non-judgmental position. It also allows you balanced priorities. Think how many times in life you wake up each morning and you're just overwhelmed just by the priorities you've got. You've got too many damn priorities. You've got too much on your plate. And you're afraid to give any of it up, because who's going to think what of you when you give one of those priorities up that affects them? Now shame, guilt, and fear are motivating your priorities. You're walking around with this enormous amount of priorities thinking, my God, if I only got rid of these priorities, I'd have a life. But every time you go to get rid of a priority, someone comes around and reminds you, hold on a second, you're successful, we like you, we honor you because of that priority you're committed to. And you think, well, gee whiz, how am I going to change my commitments? Think of what you commit yourself to. Think of who you commit yourself to. Think of what you commit yourself to. And then think, if you had to do it all over again to make different choices, would those be the same priorities and the same commitments? Now, we're known by the word of our commitment being honored. So then they bring in words that they know are going to keep us locked in. Well, you've got to honor your word. You've given a commitment, now honor it. And now we have to. But what if it's a wrong commitment to the wrong people for the wrong thing? I see this all the time in people. You are an affront to the value that they don't have. So what do we do in our society? In order to get along, we lower our standards. We bring ourselves down to where they're at so we can belong, because we're told that you're nobody unless you belong to something, right? You got to belong to guilds and clubs and rules and societies and fraternities and parties and Republican, Democrat, and if you don't belong to somebody, then you're an outsider, you're a nobody, you're a loner. So we make belonging important. Well, when you belong, you have to acquiesce. What do you have to give up to belong? Well, Marty Feldman, sitting in the back of this room, who had belonged to the group of neurologists and conservative academics at Mount Sinai and Columbia University, when one day he woke up and for whatever reason he chose that it was more important to honor the real healing energy and his own dynamic self, he had to separate himself from those people whose values would have been different. Marty's values continued to expand. Theirs continued to contract. How do you think they would perceive Marty? Marty is quiet, self-effacing, conservative. But because he chose to learn new information that gave him a greater power in his healing without the old armamentarium of drugs, he becomes a threat. Therefore, since not able to convince Marty to come back to the old ways where he would have been rewarded financially and socially in his career, they now had to exclude him. Maybe not to his face, but behind his back. In fact, I know for a fact when I was checking some snide remarks people made about him up the university, and it had nothing to do with quality, had to do with the fact that he had chosen another path. So they had to exclude him. Now, you can't say nice things about people you've excluded. The very nature of our choices is that if you choose to be in one direction, you must exclude everyone else and you must badmouth them. So now he is on the outside. But Marty isn't a part of the holistic health community. So he's excluded from them. He's a threat to them. He doesn't have a big practice. He doesn't have a big office. He's not like these people that run you in, charge you $5,000, have you see all these other people, fundamentally don't help you, but know that you're vulnerable and you're desperate, so they're going to exploit it. So he doesn't have one of these practices. He's got a single practice, sees 10, 12 people a day and gives some time to him. He helps what he can, who he can't help, he lets them know he can't help them. Well, now he's a threat to both sides, to the orthodox and the alternative. That leaves him alone. So Marty spends most of his time alone. Right? But he's happy. Because Marty Feldman has accepted himself. He'd rather have his own company unconditionally than someone else's in conditions he cannot accept. Now think of how many times you've compromised to do this. I knew people who were driving out to a race one time, and in the car was a person who was a chronic complainer, whiner, blamer, gossip, badmouth, nasty person. When I got to the race, I was already at the race, someone came over and said, Jesus, you can't believe the nightmare we just went through. I said, why didn't you tell the person to go their own route? Well, you know, we were kind of a group, so you allowed one negative person to pollute a whole group, to make your whole trip miserable, and no one would stand up to the person. Think how many times you've done that. Think how many times you've been around people, and because you were fearful, losing your job, losing a relationship, you allowed things to go that had you made other choices, you'd have said, no way, no way. It's about choices. Power is in the choice. Make the wrong choice, you disempower. But by the very nature of your capacity to make a choice, you are empowering yourself. And you're also alienating yourself from everyone who thinks that because you're not one of them, you don't hang out with them, you don't believe in what they believe, that you're different, you're bad, you're this or that. You can't change what people think about you. Don't even try. The need to make other people think well about you itself is a dysfunction. If we didn't have people needing to have people think well of them, we'd have honesty in politicians. Do you know an honest politician? Unfortunately, in the nature of our society today, it becomes impossible because the choices that we give politicians are not capable of being met and also being balanced. They can't be balanced and be honest. Because the moment they're starting to be honest, it's going to segregate all those people who don't want to be honest. All right? So they compromise. When you compromise, everybody knows you've compromised, and they don't like you anymore for it, but they'll tolerate you. We have a very high threshold for tolerance. But tolerance is not acceptance. It's just that. It's tolerance. That's why public opinion polls go up and down, and you'll see the political machinations, you'll see the manipulations based upon if the politicians are up. If the politicians are down, they suddenly start a war. Suddenly, I'm sure since we've already fought the greatest wars in history in the last 10 years, we had to go in and wipe out and stop forever the drug running in Nicaragua, and then in Panama, boy, we cleaned up the drugs in Panama, didn't we? And we showed them, didn't we? Well, it helped his image. Now people thought, I'm an insecure male. I need to see a secure male that I can have confidence in believing in. So he became the secure hero figure for all the insecure men. A part of the success of life is becoming a minimalist and learning to live fear-free. A minimalist is a person who decides one day that they don't need everything they had in their life in order to be happy. So they start making a list of the things that they don't need to give their time and attention to. They start excluding things that they can live without and still be happy. And things we thought we couldn't live without, when we go through the addictive withdrawal stage of getting them out, including the people that we thought we couldn't live without, that weren't healthy and happy for us, we go through withdrawal, the pain, the separation, and suddenly we recover and we feel better than ever before. And we think, my God, why did I take so long to make this decision? The problem is not getting the people out. The problem is making a decision other than fear. Fear keeps you coming back to the predictable patterns. Fear always brings you back to orthodoxy. Why do you think more people than ever before are going into orthodox religions? To find their spirituality? No. Certainty. They need certainty. The redemption of a life that they have not, through their own spiritual day-to-day process, redeems them. They become a part of the greater the redemption, the larger whole. And then they have to exclude and overlook all the inconsistencies within it. Well, what if you told someone you don't have to believe in anything that's orthodox in order to be spiritual, to be loving, giving, kind? And if Buddha, Muhammad, Christ, any of these sages throughout history, if they were here today and you had a discussion with them, say, hold on a second, if I'm living based upon the laws of universal love, and by love you cannot dishonor anything it's not love, you can't steal, you can't cheat, you can't lie, then am I not in myself a temple of the higher being? What are they going to say? No? No. I doubt that. But we're afraid of that. We're terrified because of the choices. Our choices are made by people we've given the process of being the deciphers of life, as if somehow we can't figure it out for ourselves. And we never look at the excesses that they have and the imbalances. A minimalist takes advantage of their life and restructures their life by only what should be in there is in there. What's important is what they focus on. What is not is excluded. They simply give it away, throw it away, or use it. Now think if you had to use those notions when you go home today. Anything that is not essential to your life, you gave it away tomorrow. You can only have stuff in your life that you use. And it has to be consistent and positive to your larger ideal. What would you be left with? Some of you would just be naked on the street tomorrow morning. You see something is not working for you. You want something to change to be better. When do you want this to happen? What decides the timetable that you're going to make it change? What? You see something's not working, you want it to change. Now, what makes the timetable start to work that you're going to change or not change? What? What's easiest? All right. Got to develop a plan.
Setting goals.
Setting goals. What else?
Frustration.
Commitment, frustration.
Insecurity.
Insecurity. It's all about choices again. Something doesn't work, you want to change it, but when do you want it to change? You're only going to change it when you have enough confidence that what you're changing to is going to be better than what you're changing from. Now listen carefully to this. If you need the certainty of knowing that what you're going to change to, and that starts the clock of real change, then that's never going to happen. Because real change can never be certain. Real change requires an unknown, living with the unknown, accepting the unknown, embracing the unknown. That's where real change occurs. Then there's no clock that ever has to be stopped. You can immediately start because you're not waiting until the certainty. Well, I don't have this yet. I don't have that yet. I don't have any of this yet. Well, at what point do you have everything that you need? Because what's going to go into your needs are your insecurity. I can't make the change till all these other insecurities are met. Well, of course, we place so much of the false and artificial insecure self into the new self, into the new equation, that it's not going to be any different. We change from one bad relationship to another bad relationship, one job we didn't like to another job we didn't like, move from one place to another place, but it doesn't fundamentally change anything because we needed the certainties, therefore we knew ultimately what would happen when we moved, when we did. Try making a change where you have no knowledge of the outcome. And by the way, that's almost always where your greatest breakthroughs in medicine, nutrition, healthcare, and everything else comes, when you don't know the outcome and you're willing to try something that no one's tried before. That's when you come up with answers. We have millions of scientists every year using enormous amounts of resources to duplicate the same old line of reasoning, and they don't find anything new. And all that we do is always revolutionary. Like the egg project, finding that we don't need any animal protein. That was revolutionary. Because I said simply, something's wrong here. I know people who don't need any animal protein who are healthier than people who do. So how in the world can we be accepting that only people who eat animal protein are healthy? The standards were wrong. The belief system was wrong. The choices, therefore, were wrong. When you disobeyed and disallowed that and chose the unknown, I don't know what they're doing, but I'm going to find out, suddenly there were answers. Had I not tried that, had I not accepted the unknown could be something fruitful, I wouldn't have tried it. I'd gone back to the same old belief system and stayed a registered dietitian. That's what happens. That's what happens in anything we do in life. That's why so many doctors I see, even alternative doctors, don't help people because they stay with what they know instead of what might be an unknown. It's very hard to tell a patient, I don't know what's going to happen, I don't know if this is going to work, but are you willing to try this? And that's where frequently you get your greatest breakthroughs. You can live your whole life with artificial needs. We start hearing people about, well, I have to compromise this and I have to compromise that. Suddenly one day they're nothing but a compromise. And then they feel rotten because they were never encouraged to be honest about, look, I've been telling you I like this whole line, I don't like it. It's not your fault. I should have been honest. This is what I really like. And isn't it important that we do what we like instead of what's expected? But society tells you to do what's expected. We're supposed to accept all these compromises. Well, that's one way of keeping people in control. I'm not a believer that we have to do things in a compromising way. I believe there's no shortage of good quality people to share the best that you want to be, and they respect that and share the best that they are at the same time. Complementing energies is a wonderful experience.
Hopefully you find some motivation behind what was said. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.